All right, so for those who heard Jean-François Jouani a few weeks ago, they can go out and they have fun. And so this is something we started something like 2 years ago or a little more, which was initiated by a seminar that Xavier Sastre. So Xavier is a medical doctor at the Curie Hospital, and so Xavier organized a seminar, in fact, on uterus cancer. And it was a lucky day. I could go there and listen to whatever was said. And there's two things which really turned me on. And then I went to Jean-François and we decided we would work on this problem. And these two things were, this is a cancer which is driven by virus, papilloma virus. And it turns out that about one woman out of three has this virus. And fortunately enough, one woman out of 100,000 will develop a tumor. And the conventional wisdom is to say that the virus stay dormant for a very long time, and all of a sudden it will wake up, when I don't really know what that means. And so I had the idea that maybe some physical argument could help, and maybe we can come back at the end of the talk to see whether it's true or not. And there was another observation that Xavier made, was that basically 100% of the tumors would arise at the interface between two epithelial tissues. So from just these two observations, I had the idea that maybe physics has something to say, which is, you know, maybe completely naive, but anyway. So we started to work on that, and then Xavier helped us a lot, gave us tutorials and so on. So what I'm going to talk about today is basically a large part of Marcus Bazin's PhD thesis. And I show simulation done in collaboration between Marcus and Jens Elgeti. I'll also speak of things we are right now doing with Jonas Rant and Frank Ulicher. And Thomas is part of the whole thing, and of course Jean-François. I'll mention a few preliminary experiments done by Fabien Montel in Giovanni Scapello's group, and in collaboration with Daniel Avingevit, who is a biologist in the cell biology department at the Curie Institute. First I will introduce something which we call a homeostatic state. Which we could just call it steady state, but we thought for medical doctors it might be better, but we don't know. Then I will tell why whatever concept we get from that may be useful for understanding competition for space. And then we'll introduce a one-component description of tissues, or the dynamics of tissues. Then I will discuss a little bit the two-component description, not too much, but a little bit. Say a few things about fluctuations. Then come to the experiments, and then I'll discuss whatever physiological relevance we can think of, and probably by that time you'll be fed up. All right, so let's first talk about this idea of steady state. And suppose you have a chamber, and this chamber has walls which let through the fluid, the nutrients, the growth factors, everything. And you let a cell grow in that chamber, and one side of the chamber is made of a freely moving piston, so the piston is also permeable to all fluid, nutriment, and so on, and it's connected to a spring. And you let this tissue grow, and you let it grow, and so the tissue will push up on the spring, and as the spring is pushed, and it develops a force, so a stress, which will fight against the motion of the tissue. And the bet is that at some point, so as the stress grows, the duplication rate will slow down, the apoptosis rate will crank up, and at some point you'll get a steady state. And this steady state defines both a density and a stress, a steady state stress, which is a characteristic of the tissue. And that defines a very original state of matter in the sense that suppose now I switch ensemble and I work in an ensemble where I control the pressure or the stress rather than than putting a piston. Now if I exert a stress which is slightly larger than the steady state stress, the apoptosis rate will win over the duplication rate, and you'll push the piston will now will move to the left, and will push this tissue until it completely disappears. If the stress is a little bit smaller, then the duplication rate will win over the apoptosis rate, and the piston will push to the right, and the tissue will swell to infinity. So if you think of it, it's a state of matter in which there is no compression modulus to all orders, and I know of no other state of matter with no compression modulus. I mean, even at a critical point, the linear compression modulus goes to zero, but you have non-linear compressibility. Yes. No, this is stress. This is why I'm not saying pressure. This is not hydrostatic pressure. It has nothing to do. That's a very important point.
Okay.
And it's a somewhat of a delicate point. You know, the fluid flows freely through the... You know, I paid attention to tell that the fluid can go freely through the walls, which means it's not hydrostatic pressure.
Okay.
And it's a stress which is... It's a weird stress. Because it also has nothing to do with the osmotic pressure, because the salt, the nutrients, growth factor, they also flow through the walls. So it's really this part of the stress which is connected to the cell mechanics. So it's like, I mean, the when Eva is pushing on her cell or something, so it's really what is directly coupled to the cell mechanics. But it would be, I mean, if you were to consider that the molecule would be the cells, it would be some kind of osmotic stress, but of the cells, if you wish. But it's very different from hydrostatic pressure. And indeed, you could, you know, you can crank up the hydrostatic pressure by a factor of 10, and this will still hold. Yes?
Two tissues with different homeostatic pressure, then one would always be over the other. You would never get stable in the middle.
This is the next slide. No. Okay. Right, here you are. You're too fast. Excuse me?
Don't you introduce some anisotropy or having a spring from one side?
No, I mean, you could, okay, no, it's just, anisotropy is a very interesting quantity that maybe we can say a few words later on. But suppose this does not introduce anisotropy. Yes.
I just have a technical experimental question. So, but if you press on a tissue, it's going to apply this kind of, I mean, like, probably
doesn't have experimentally. We are going to do that, and I'll show one attempt. And actually, we are working hard to do it more carefully. And okay, you can talk about that later.
So this yes. works with metazoans. This works with cells that are used to living in multicellular organs. So it's tissue.
Yes.
So it's not a cell property, it's a tissue property.
Right? It's a tissue property, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, I mean, if I come back here, if I come back here, you would say also that the size, the lateral size, cannot be very large, because the nutriment, I assume that the nutriments penetrate everywhere, and there is no problem with nutriment or growth factor whatsoever. In practice, you'll see that there are problems of getting the food down some length scale into the tissue. But I assume here, I assume that all these length scales are small. I mean, that we are at a scale smaller than these length scales.
I have the same thing on the left side. I had a thin mesh, loose mesh work embedded in the fluid, and I allow the fluid to.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't understand the question.
The
which left side? Here?
I mean that compartment. If I have a loose meshwork embedded in the fluid, and I push against the piston, which releases the fluid.
Well, not quite, because it depends on the elastic properties of the meshwork. Yeah. But that could be. I mean, we could work that out, but it's, I would not expect it to be quite the same. Okay, so let's come to Ogier's question. And now we have, but he's already gave the answer. It's too fast, this guy. So now you have to take two chambers, and you separate them by also a freely moving piston. And suppose for a second that they don't talk to each other, biochemically speaking. So this piston is impermeable here, but these sides are permeable enough that they get, again, you have no problem with nutriments and growth factors. But a priori, the two tissues, they have different solicited pressures. And they will start to develop. The pressure will crank up, and they say if this compartment has a lower steady state pressure, at some point this steady state pressure will be reached. So this guy will have as many duplication as apoptosis, but these guys keeps on dividing. So I mean the cells keeps on dividing more than dying, and so the piston will push. The pressure will crank up a little higher then the steady state pressure of that tissue, and the apoptosis will win over duplication, and there is no compromise. So this tissue will completely be suppressed from the chamber. So as you said, I mean, that tissue which has a larger steady state pressure will always win under those conditions to the other tissue. Now you could say, suppose that this tissue is able to communicate biochemically with this neighboring tissue, and that it sends a signal which favors apoptosis, for instance. So even though it has a lower steady state pressure, you might think that this could help. Well, suppose now that the signal will have a finite penetration length. So suppose that the chamber has a size which is small compared to that penetration length, then it's clear that this tissue will completely wipe out this one, because in the presence of the signal, its own steady state pressure is smaller than that of this guy. But now if the chamber is very big, even if you lose a few cells there, you get so many more there that it will the piston will be pushed and this guy will be wiped out. So you see there is a critical length which shows up, and which might let you think that with biochemical signals of the right sign, you might have a critical length for nucleating for, let's say, a tumor. It turns out this is irrelevant. And this is irrelevant because cancer is an evolutionary pathology. Those mutations which would, you know, fall under this category, they are basically unsuccessful and you don't see them. Those mutations that you see take advantage of the normal tissue. Actually, what happens is that they are not suffering from the neighborhood of the normal tissue, they are taking advantage of it. They are taking the growth factors of the normal tissue. So this question, I mean, this idea of a critical length scale because of biochemistry doesn't really hold. Okay. Yes?
But in a cancer, does the neighboring tissue actually disappear?
Or what?
Does actually in a brain cancer, does the neighboring tissue actually disappear? I thought the tumor just grows and...
It pushes it, right?
Does it die?
But for a long time, it doesn't disappear. If you look at many types, I mean, they completely grow. They're really nasty. First, they take advantage of the neighboring tissue, and then they also send signaling messages which recruit new cells, and these new cells generate even more growth factors for the tumor. So they are really taking complete advantage of the neighboring tissue.
But so at some point, the neighboring tissue dies.
At some point, it will die. As long as you get an interface. And actually, the cancer tissue also dies further on. I mean, there is a front, but then we may discuss that later on. But there'll be a front, and the front is moving. But yeah.
The model seems to leave out the mechanical effect in the sense that you would think that the left-hand side impinges on the right. That it would mechanically compress it.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying.
The pressure would build up.
Yes.
It would reach a new
equilibrium. No. I mean, that's the point. These tissues, let's come back to this one compartment. If the stress is larger than the steady state stress, there is no compressional modulus on long term, and it flows. So that's what I'm saying. It's a very unique state of matter. Compression modulus is zero on a long time scale, and I'm going to show it in a second. But even within this Gedanken experiment, you see it.
Okay. It seems unrealistic.
No, we have a compression modulus on short time scale, like any state of matter. But now you have no compressional modulus because if the stress increases above the steady state stress, then the cell death wins over duplication. And you move, but you move very slowly. You move on a time scale of cell death and cell division, which is, say, days. So it has nothing to do with the usual idea we have of mechanics,
but
it's still there.
You're using a, I don't know, maybe it's still kind of thing. Like your model or like any elastic model is defining equilibrium, and you're talking about the state that is like, so we. This only holds when it's like one is winning on the other. So it's you're in a non-steady state. Or you can be a steady state.
No, there is, well, I'm going to show you, then you have a relation. Actually, you have a relation between stress difference and actually velocity gradients.
Okay, what you mean is that locally in time, adiabatically, you have a.
Of course, you're in low Reynolds number.
No,
so things are balanced and force is conserved.
Okay, so in that case, actually, it's in that case, it's the
normal. Yeah. Okay, so let's get to the proof, because it's very simple. So now you have a cell conservation law, which actually was not conserved. So you have a conserved piece, and of course you have a source, right? And the source tells you, I mean, is simply the division rate minus the death rate times the cell concentration. This is the conserved piece as usual. In fact, you can also write a noise source. And the noise source, you write it just by comparison with the master equation. And so you know how to write that term here. Stress, of course, should be conserved. And now if I come back to that guy, and I write it in a slightly different way. So I say, so I can, you know all of that. You can write that, so the time derivative of the cell density is the difference between the rates, and the it can also come from the surface, so it's minus the divergence of velocity field of the cells. Now, if we sit close to the steady state we've been defining, you can expand the difference between the division and apoptosis rate as a function of the density difference with respect to the cell density at steady state. Okay, now if I put that back into the conservation equation, I see that this introduces a time scale over, and it's in a non-hydrodynamic time scale in that it does not depend on scale. And so you see that after this time, the tissue density will relax to something in which these two guys balance each other. And now, if you get, so if you start from a description in which there is a relation between density and stress, so just the way you want it, Danielle, so, and this would be like for any standard fluid. Now, because if you go to a larger, time larger than time scale introduced in the previous slide, you can see that you can replace the density difference by the divergence, or minus, but the divergence of the cell velocity field. So you plug it back here, and you find that the stress is a proportion to the divergence of the velocity field. And of course, the question is the viscosity, and it's just as usual, times these time scales multiplied by the compressional elastic modulus. So these systems at long time behave like fluids for the compressional modulus, which I don't know of any other system doing that, around steady state. If you go away from steady state, then you have to keep track of the whole dependence on of the duplication rate and apoptosis rate. But so this is a unique, and you can do it for any time, and you find it's a Maxwell fluid for the isotropic piece. Now you can do the same thing for the deviatoric part of the stress, and now it's a little bit different, but it boils down to the same result. If you start from an elastic medium, and now you introduce the fact that you have division and apoptosis. Each event is a localized event, and you can describe it like you describe dislocation loops in solids by introducing the dipole moment of, say, the dislocation loop, or in that case, dipole moment, elastic dipole moment corresponding to divisions or apoptosis. And they are characterized by numbers, prefactors, and something which tell you how cell division is anisotropic, and how apoptosis could be anisotropic. Actually, apoptosis you would expect to be weakly anisotropic. But anyway, and now, so and if you have a large enough tissue, you have to average these guys. And in an isotropic tissue, of course, the average should be zero, except that if it is biased by an external stress field, and this external stress field, just from dimensional analysis, is related to. So now, what is important is that is the time derivative of this elastic dipole, which is connected to apoptosis and cell division. So this is a time derivative of this elastic dipole, which is proportional to the stress. And now if you just do the algebra, you wind up again with a Maxwell fluid, and now the for the anisotropic piece. We don't know much about the noise source in that case. For the isotropic piece, we know how to write the noise source. here, we know there's going to be a noise source, but we don't know enough to write it from first principle. Note also that the sign of this guy is not guaranteed. And we can discuss the case where it's not unstable, but I probably won't have time today. But if that would give you an emetic phase.
What's the
what? So n is a direction of, say, if you have a duplication, you can define an axis for the duplication, and this n would be the duplication axis. For apoptosis, it's less obvious because, you know, but the surrounding may define some axis, and so you can do in principle the same thing. But this, I would assume this is probably small and this is probably significant. But you don't care because at the end of the day, it's always lumped into that parameter. And we can talk about that maybe at the end of the talk, what happens if this guy is negative.
The apoptosis rate was linear.
Okay, this is our expansion for small stresses around the steady state stress. So the homeostatic stress. So homeostatic stress for an isotropic tissue, then the anisotropic part is zero. So this is just the stress here. And where do I come back? Here it has to be the difference between, say, the real stress and the homeostatic stress for the isotropic part. It's yes.
Understand why we need to even mention viscosity. So I'm staring at this equation. If I set viscosity to zero, because
there's no viscosity to start with. There's only compressional modulus, and there is this time is connected to apoptosis, and it's just tau chi. This is not introduced. This is found. Okay, I never introduce any viscosity at that stage. I find it.
So can I just think of this as this tissue is in instantaneous mechanical equilibrium but undergoes sort of plastic relaxation?
Exactly.
Right? If you model
causing
cell death or
exactly. And this plastic behavior eventually looks exactly like a fluid a long time.
Except that you don't have a yield effect.
Okay, cool.
Except there's no yield stress.
Yeah, sure.
No, you're right. It's exactly plastic behavior driven by duplication and apoptosis. Yes.
So at this point, in realistic tissues, I imagine the edges, the boundaries will change what's going on. So apoptosis on the boundary, the laws of anisotropy will be different.
Was that yeah, probably, yes. Probably, yeah. Where are we? Okay, you'll see. I mean, there are places where clearly one could do that. Yeah. Okay, now there's one thing also you could say that and it's not only the cells, but you also have interstitial fluid. And so we can keep track of that. And if we keep track of it, and we can even impose that the total system is incompressible, because it's clear that. And now we are speaking of real hydrostatic pressure with respect to real hydrostatic pressure. So the total system is incompressible. You can enforce that by introducing a two-fluid description. So keeping track of the cell density and the interstitial fluid density, and what it really does, it gives one more relation, which is the permeation of interstitial fluid through the cells, and that's about all. And so, which introduces a length scale, which is like in any system where you have both viscosity and permeation, which is the ratio of the viscous coefficient divided by the permeation coefficient. And if you look at some model behavior, what you find, for instance, if I come back to this piston experiment, you find that within the length scale defined here, everything works as if the system was one component system, and beyond that length scale, essentially the tissue sits at its homeostatic pressure. So it behaves like a screening length where telling you that beyond that length, the system is at in steady state conditions, and within that length is one component. Okay, now that's okay. Let's just, so this is a video just for fun, actually, that Fabien made. So this is over something like a 10-day type of video, so it speeded up tremendously. And so you see the duplication, but you still see like it just looked like dew. So the small aggregates fuse and they grow, which is a typical behavior of a fluid. And it also show you something, I'm going to come back on it, which is that there is surface tension, there is interfacial tension. Here is another experiment which is done in Francois Bouchard group by Karen Gevorkian in that case. Now you take a cell aggregate, I forget how many cells here, but a few thousand cells, and you impose a pressure difference between outside and inside of so you start with 1 kilopascal pressure difference. After 1 hour, you switch to 2 kilopascal. 2 hours, 3 kilopascal, and so on. And so it's a 5-hour movie. And so from the motion and the shape and so on, you can extract viscosity and interfacial tension. Actually, Francois finds, or Karen finds, that interfacial tension grows with pressure, in fact. It's not completely constant in her experiment. And she can measure viscosity. Now, this is at time scales which are shorter than cell division times, and which means that for the shear part, and what she measures the shear viscosity, not bulk, but for the shear part, for many cell aggregates and probably many tissues, the tissue behaves like a fluid much before, way before having duplication and apoptosis. But even if it didn't, at very long time you would find a fluid behavior.
So the fluid behavior that you get at shorter time scales is because of just the reorganizational.
Yeah, it's because just like a foam, basically. Yeah.
But foams can be solid.
What?
Foams can be in the solid state as well.
Depend on time scale again.
No.
But then in the course and then they
can be stably solid.
Depending on whether this T process exists or not, or something. Okay. Yeah, but they do here. Okay. So we tried these ideas with simulations. So I am notoriously very bad in simulations, but Jens Elgeti, who graduated with Gerhard Gomper, is good, and So the way they simulated the cells by pairing point particles, and this point particle first interacts through some potential, and they change. Here is a Morse potential, but they change. They tried other type of potentials. You allow them to have an apoptosis probability, so they can disappear with some probability. And you move them apart at constant speed, for instance. And whenever the distance is larger than the critical distance, you give them a probability to duplicate.
Duplication rate always larger than apoptosis rate?
Excuse me?
Is KD always larger than KA? What do I mean there?
Oh, you'll see. Yeah, if you want to see something, you have to start with conditions such that KD is larger, but then you can cook up conditions such that it will adjust spontaneously to steady state. And but so what? I don't know. Maybe I can show the video at the end of the or whichever. You're the boss. No, I don't know. Maybe at the end. I'll show that at the end. Okay. So now we can. So there are several things you can do. I mean, first you can check that this question of tissue weaning works, but that's fairly easy. And you can track the motion of single cells, so to speak, as a function of time, and you see that so. And you turn on duplication, and in fact you get to steady state where duplication and apoptosis are the same. So you just have one parameter, and so what they see is that for if there is no duplication or no apoptosis. Then the cell don't move, so you start from a solid. Okay, and you turn on K, and you see that so the mean square displacement as a function of time is linear and grows as you crank up the duplication rate. And now you can extract, and it's linear in time, so there's a diffusion constant, and you can extract the diffusion constant as a function of the duplication rate. And you can also do a calculation from, I told you we have the noise term. So we can do what you do with liquids to find the diffusion constant. And so calculate the velocity-velocity correlation function. What we find if we do this calculation, and the diffusion constant is proportional to both the depletion rate and its square. And so that's what Jens find here, and in fact, in that case, it seemed that we also see the square piece of it.
John, I got a little off. What the points represent individual cells in your Morse potential simulation?
Oh, I'm sorry. What happens? Okay. Yeah, 2 points. The points are paired. And 2 points represent the cell. Yes. And then they interact.
Half a cell. What's the meaning of a point that's isolated?
No, the meaning is that it allows you. I mean, that gives you an internal coordinate, which tells you when it's going to divide. That's what it is. It's just one way of. Introducing stochastic division.
So
you could imagine other ways, but this is a way which will depend on interaction and depend on concentration. That's why we did it that way. Okay, and you could also shear this guy and try to measure. A shear modulus or a shear viscosity if you go to a very long time. And in fact, you do find, but you also find nonlinear rheology. I mean, it's all, we are disentangling that right now. I mean, it's very hard to get to very low shear rates in the simulations. So at very low shear rates, you find a viscosity, but you get. You get very easily out of the linear regime, in fact. Okay, another thing you can do is, since we have the equation, you can put this tissue on a rigid substrate and bounded by a flexible membrane with tension and curvature modulus, and work out the fluctuation spectrum of this guy. And so what you find is what I would call a Rouse membrane. I mean, if you had a membrane here and a usual fluid, and you're looking at thermal fluctuation of that membrane, if you look at the wavelengths large compared to the thickness, you would find here terms which would be very different because of conservation of the fluid you would find that the tension term would go like what was it, k to the 4, and the curvature term would go like k to the 6. You will pick up two more powers of wave vector. And the difference here is due to the fact, again, that the number of cells is not conserved. So the main dynamics is basically in the direction orthogonal to membrane in this wave vector range here. If you look at the equal time displacement of the membrane, you find it is exactly the usual thing that you get for a membrane, but the noise source has nothing to do with temperature, but it's again, it's proportional to the duplication rate. I would say probably squared, because there is also a duplication rate here in this effective viscosity. But what it tells you, I think the most important thing it tells you, is that you can again define a Helfrich length, which means that you know that you have a membrane close to a wall. This membrane has finite probability to hit the wall. And that gives you the repulsive interaction that Helfrich discussed years ago and so on. I mean, the whole physics connected to that. But in that case, it tells you that if you have a tissue and an interface, there is a finite probability for the thickness of this guy to go to zero. So it will look patchy in the presence of noise. And there is a characteristic length scale over which this can happen. So this is at steady state. And of course, you're right that if you go slightly, you know, one way or the other, it will shoot, and there will be exponentially increasing differences between the large height position and the small height position. That we didn't discuss. Well, we'll see also. We discuss in a slightly different conditions, but yes, that's something which will come out.
This would be a limit of the interposition.
Yeah. So we've done this calculation, but not including the noise term. Just looking at instabilities, and this of course would be
Why do you have a bending between? I mean, in the standard tension between.
I'll show you experiments in which what dominates actually is the bending rigidity. So which is exactly that case. We can do experiments where this is the leading term. Okay, so here are the experiments. So you take a cell aggregate, just like the one Karen Gevorkian and Francois Bouchard have been playing with. And now you put pressure on both sides. So you want these walls, you want as permeable and so on. And it turns out that one way we've done that is by using dialysis bags. So you put your cell aggregate in a dialysis bag, and you impose an osmotic pressure difference between outside and inside the dialysis bag. And you look at the growth of this guy. I mean, so, and changing the outside pressure. Now, if the volume was conserved and if you squeeze, then the diameter should grow, right? Now let's look at the preliminary data. First, this blue curve is without pressure whatsoever. And you see, and you put some number of cells, and then with the starting diameter is 600 microns, so it's already squeezed. Here is no squeezing, sorry. And it grows to an average size of 850 micron after like 2 weeks, right? And it seems to be, so this isn't probably noise. So this is essentially steady state. And now, So why is it that you get to a steady state first? Because from all the arguments I told you, we should not, right? But in fact, it gets to a steady state because nutrients don't penetrate in the middle, and also oxygen. I mean, which is and it's known, and doctors know that very well. Whenever oxygen don't get inside the tumor, the center of the tumor is necrosed. So and that's what's happening here. But it's a steady state, and so it's entirely due to the lack of penetration of both nutrients and probably oxygen. Now, if you increase the pressure outside, so you put a little pressure, you see that the steady state value decreases. Here it's just for 30 pascals, so it's not much, but the internal pressure may be very different. So this is external pressure, you have to calculate the whole shape problem and so on. So I did the calculation, but I didn't exploit them. So you see here that they're different asymptote, and here we washed out the exterior and restore a zero osmotic pressure difference outside, and you see you get to the same steady state. So it's really a steady state. And now if you crank up even more, you decrease the diameter even more, and beyond that, what happens is it essentially collapses. So Fabien Montel, who was doing the experiment, didn't like the this collapse very much, because it was telling me there's something wrong going on. The aggregate breaks into pieces. And what I believe is that this break into pieces correspond to this Hessfrick length, because you know that it's going to be a collision length, and so I want him to do more experiments there to check that. And okay, do I want to say more on that?
Do you know that's a fragmentation or a collapse because observations?
Yeah, because of the observations, yes.
On the graph, it could just be another steady state.
No, here it's another steady state, and I'm sorry. But if we crank it a little more, it goes, it's very brutal, and you lose everything, basically. But it's not, You could think that this diameter would decrease, but there is something brutal and it splits into pieces. Yeah.
Repeat these experiments. How many people are the experiments?
We are having a hard time, but it's not that easy to. To at least if you are not, because we. All these experiments were done in Daniela Vinkevich lab, and now we want to use microfluidics and so on. So we transferred everything in our lab, and we are not expert in tissue and aggregates growing, and we are having great difficulties in keeping them alive. You have to be very clean and so on, and we have to learn. So it's. This piece is very slow. I mean, the microfluidics we have, but right now we are unable to grow new aggregates since we've been moving things in our lab. So maybe we'll come back to Daniela's lab. I don't know. But it looks easy if you do that in the right lab. But if you want to do it in your own lab, you learn that you have to be very clean. But you've done things, right, Boris? You know that. It was no problem for you. I don't know.
But actually, what's the scale of all the experiments? So presumably a difference in transporting it from that experiment to your microfluidics is that you now do it with what? 100 microns? scale?
It's a microscopic experiment, right? Yeah, and it goes, and in fact, the why we wanted to switch to microfluidics is that it's not that easy to get to analyze the thin samples, and that's what we really want to do. And so with microfluidics, as you said, you control much better the 100 micron scale.
But roughly this was millimeters?
This is 500 microns, actually. So you have the scale. So this is millimeter, and this is half a millimeter, and yeah. Now also I can tell OJ that in that case, in fact, the membrane of the dialysis bag is essentially curvature dominated. So the response of the membrane, you can basically neglect the tension, and it's all curvature. It's a very high curvature modulus, but it's curvature dominated.
So there's something that I don't understand. So you said, if I understood correctly, you mean that the tissue has homeostatic pressure. Okay, and the homeostatic stress, if you want. Okay?
No, not in that case, right? I want to measure, so I shouldn't have been clear enough. In that case, the aggregate reaches a steady state, which has nothing to do with the homeostatic pressure, just because of new treatment.
Okay?
But now you crank up the outside pressure, and your aggregate size decreases. And when it's going to be, so I'm sorry, I haven't been clear enough. And when it decreases enough, now you are at scales for which you don't have to worry about bringing nutrients, and then you are going to measure the homeostatic pressure. That's exactly the point.
What is the scale at which you don't have to worry?
What?
What is the scale at which you don't have to worry?
It would be like Boris said, about 100 microns. But we don't know. I mean, people haven't measured it. So it would also be a measure of that scale. Because what we are expecting is something, let's say, size as a function of pressure. We'd expect something like that, with some kind of abrupt fall off, which we seem to see. And looking at the size of the aggregate in this region would give you information on the nutriment length scale. And so the microfluidics experiment should be done with different sizes of the chambers. Okay, what time is it? Okay, fine. Now, upon speaking with Xavier and so on, and reading literature, we came up with something which is known as metastatic inefficiency, and which may have something also to do with this papillomavirus. And so you can invade the lung or the liver of a mouse with basically 100,000 cancer cell, and they get in very easily, in fact with very high yield, almost 100% yield. And then these people monitor the outcome of the growth. And what they see at the end of the day is that if they wait long enough, that only one cell out of 1,000 will eventually give you a tumor. All the rest will die. So they can start to grow, they can start to make, micro tumors with 8 cells or whatever, but eventually they shrink and they disappear. And only one out of 1,000 basically succeed in making a tumor, which is in fact very fortunate. And so, can one understand that? And if you just put, a tissue with a higher homeostatic pressure instead of another tissue, and you look at how it behaves, it's nothing different from what I told you in Erin chambers. I mean, the mass is a bit different because it's different geometry, but nothing changes. So you would say. This is not an experiment, it's just a calculation. They take mice. They take mice, and I think they just kill the mice and they slice the liver. So it's not one mouse, they take, I don't know. It's awful kind of experiments, because you feed them with, I don't know, you know, cancer cells, and the only way I can see that they can trace down the fate of cancer cells by killing the mice and slicing the liver. And because they have markers, they can recognize tumor cells with markers that they know well how to do. So okay, here nothing much exciting. I mean, it just tells you that if the steady state pressure is larger, it's going to grow. Let me just skip that. But if we are just introducing this, we are missing something, and this something has been understood for a long time by Malcolm Steinberg, and a lot of people have worked on these ideas since. I mean, if you take two tissues, you put them in a blender, and so you make a dispersion, and you let the tissue relax. They will phase separate according to interfacial tension between the two tissues. And you can measure this interfacial tension. So they know, you have a library of interfacial tension between different tissues and so on. So they know that very well. So if we come back to the growth of, say, a given tissue in another tissue, there's one added ingredient which we put is the effect of interfacial tension. And now let's look at a case where, so the outside tissue sits at its homeostatic pressure, the inside tissue sits at its homeostatic pressure, and now knowing the interfacial tension that defines a radius with Laplace pressure. So in those cases, these guys are at their stationary in their stationary conditions, but this is an unstable point because if the radius is a little bit smaller, now the pressure difference between this guy and this guy is going to be larger. So this guy is going to be under a pressure which is higher than its own steady state pressure. So this guy will disappear. If the radius is a bit larger, the pressure inside here is going to be a little bit smaller than the steady state pressure. The cell will divide more than they will die, and the radius will pop up. So that defines a critical radius. And this is true if the tension is constant, right? So if tension is constant, you see that this argument tells you that there is a critical radius beyond which the tumor will grow and below which the tumor will shrink.
Is it known what the shape of tumors are when they're at the stage of, you know, 5 cells or 10 cells?
That's a good question. I don't know if they really know. We know for the aggregates. If we look at aggregates, they are pretty smooth. And if you look at the let's look here. I mean, it's not perfectly smooth. It's probably if you wait longer, it will be even smoother. So it's enough to smooth out these guys. Now, you know, I said that cancer is an evolutionary disease. So it may be that those tumors which are successful escape some of that by, I mean, those mutations which have a very small tension will be much more successful than those mutations which have a strong tension. And that's rather the way one should think about it. So, and it may be that you have a first mutation, cranking up division, cell division, and then you have successive mutation, for instance, decreasing this interfacial tension, and this will become more dangerous. It's known that on average you need 6 different mutations for a tumor to be successful.
Right,
so it might be one of them.
What? When you're getting those mutations when you have, you know, thousands of cells, and you have this big.
That's true. Yeah. But now let's say first mutation probably has to be cell division, otherwise it won't go, right? Then it may be that second mutation has to decrease this interfacial tension. I don't know, but it's just one. But yeah.
I was just going to say, for metastasis, actually, cells with high attention are present.
What?
For dissemination, then most like metastatic cells have actually a higher contract, like activation.
No. Wait. I'm speaking of interfacial tension between two tissues.
But this will depend also on the.
Which will depend on the actomyosin system, that's true. But. How does it correlate with single molecule measurement, single cell measurement? It's far from obvious.
Yeah.
For instance, you know from Joseph Kay's work that cancer cells are softer than non-cancer cell, but cancer tissue are stronger, are stiffer, and on large scale. So these things are. Not quite obvious, but.
There's all sorts of complications, right? So one can ask, what is happening very early on?
That's what. This is the question we are raising.
First, so a few mutations, and so at that point, he's talking about some epithelial tissue, and then you're just getting a mutation, so somatic mutation, and so mutation. Progeny, right? So
one
of the early mutations is actually a loss of coherence, right? Loss of cell adhesion, right? And that's the kind of thing that would basically liberate your cancer cell out of a two-dimensional layer where it would be mechanically controlled, right? So it basically sort of has to go from epithelial to kind of mesenchymal state where it sort of stops appearing to the neighbors and starts crawling, etc. So then, especially with these metastatic, I guess, papilloma virus experiments, it was unclear to me. So then there are these cells, presumably, which crawl into other tissues, or what state can we really?
No. So we are talking about this. This tissue has been already invaded. Cell have been crawling, or it's a local mutation, right? So either it's primary, and it's a local mutation, or cell have been invading and they are in the other tissue.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I think it makes a big difference whether you're talking about. Mutation which sort of transforms the cell sort of locally from epithelial to mesenchymal, right? Where it attaches and
I mean, just considering when they have gone through the whole system and they've been into one other tissue. Just like in the mouse experiment where you just put them by hand and you look at the growth. Basically that's what we will be looking at. Okay, well that's this cannot be the end of the story, right? Because this will never grow, you would say, because if you start with one cell, which is known, you have a very good chances that one cell is smaller than the critical radius. So you need something else. And
it's also a possibility that this ranges like this could be controlled by the immune system, the ones that not grow up. It's a very nice hypothesis, this one, but you also
no, it turns out the
in case of the virus, and you have cancer in the virus, you also know that you have the immune system acting too.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not discussing the virus. I'm not discussing the virus.
No,
right.
I'm talking about tumors.
Yeah.
I'm not discussing the virus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Saying that if you have a cancer, which is provoked by a virus, you also have an immune response. And then the immune response can also control the small aggregates. Control, or can be also something happening helped by the immune system. There are other mechanisms. This is what they mentioned. This is a very nice.
Let me go all the way. Let me go all the way, and then we can discuss these things. Okay. So now we're just considering this one cell, which has. Which is different from the other cells around, and it can come from very far away, or it can be a local mutation. And now I want to know whether it's going to grow or not. And so the mean field argument tells you that it will never grow until it has some critical radius. And now you know that small tumors, this is small tumors are monoclonal, so it means they come from one cell. And so, which means also that you can write down a master equation, and this master equation you could put the numbers, so the probability for having more, of getting one more or getting one cell division, or from getting apoptosis, depends. So you introduce that it depends on pressure, and you keep track of the Laplace pressure And you know some of the, you don't know all the parameters, but you know some of these parameters. And now you have to calculate the splitting probability. Either, so you have absorbing boundary condition, because when the number of cells is zero, that's it, lose them. And when it gets to large enough, it will shoot out. And that you can read your favorite statistical physics book and read out the splitting probability. And now what you find is if you put reasonable numbers, first it tells you it's a nucleation process, and you find that the probability of a successful tumor, so to speak, and depends exponentially or in a very brutal way on the critical cell number. And to understand the figures which were found for mice, for instance, it tells you that the critical cell number is of order of 5 or 6 or so, and it's very and we know from physics that homogeneous nucleation is always very difficult and depend very strongly on any kind of parameter, and in particular on tension. So you can, by changing the critical number a little bit, so by changing the tension by a factor of 2, you can change this probability by an enormous factor. So the message is not so much that these numbers are reasonable, because you can cook up any place, but it's that these things will depend in a very critical way on a few numbers of parameters. And also it tells you that just like we know heterogeneous nucleation is easier than homogeneous nucleation. It explains why nucleating a tumor, and in that case, if it was on a rigid wall, is always a lot easier than in the bulk. And if you just, it would basically decrease the critical number by a factor of 2, and it depends where you sit in that curve, but again, huge effects.
What?
This is simulations using the equations, and we know the interfacial tension. I can tell you what we know and what we don't know, but since it's a nucleation process, you know that you can vary things in a tremendous way by changing a little bit the input data, so it doesn't mean too much. But so we know these guys, we know all these guys. We don't know what the homeostatic pressures are, because nobody ever measured them. We know orders of magnitudes, because some people I've grown aggregates in gels, for instance. But they grow large enough that you have these nutrient problems. So it's so you know a lower bound of these pressures. But we you don't know what is you know, the difference between two different tissues. We have no idea. So a lot of that is not known. Okay, but I think the concept makes sense. Okay. Now, if the when people speak of tumors, usually they speak of much larger tumors, and we don't know much about you know microscopic size tumors. Very little is known. People understand that you can have a real steady state, just comparable to the steady state we were speaking of in the experiments, and the aggregate experiments. Where you have normal tissue, you have a duplicating a region here near the surface. Here you have migration of cells in a necrotic core, and this is a steady state, completely stable, which can last for years, and people know that. And you start to be really in trouble once the blood vessel get into this guy and bring new treatments and everything. And so it requires angiogenesis. And it's known also, and biologists know a lot about the signaling pathways. Whenever the cells lack oxygen, they send angiogenesis messages to the surrounding world. To attract the vessels and so on, but this is. Yeah.
Are these macroscopic tumors usually spherical in nature?
So these guys, okay. Now these, as long as they are smooth and spherical, that they are not dangerous.
Right.
And they start to become dangerous when you have angiogenesis and they get you know rough surfaces. Mm-hmm. And I forgot to say something is that. Where is it? No, I'm sorry. This is it. Here. If the tension was growing faster than the radius, then this guy, you would have something which would reach a completely stable, steady state, even without nutrient problems. And it turns out that the surgeons tell me that when they cut open a benign tumor, they always see some kind of that it was under some kind of stress. So I don't know if it's related or not, but there is a strong layer surrounding the benign tumor, and it's an inside inside there is a stress. So that's.
So how does the surgeon judge whether? I accept what you're saying, but I don't understand.
Well, they tell me when they cut it open, it pops.
Okay.
That's what they are saying. So I mean, this is not a measure, right? I mean, but that's what. And they are, at least they are not surprised when if I talk to them and they tell me, well, it rings a bell, and they know. They know that if they send the tumor to analysis, it will not the outcome will not be malignant. They know that out of experience. Okay, so that also meant, so that piece also you can calculate is not very, and we've done it. I don't know, and we can in fact there's two way you can do that either by. So introducing explicitly nutriments and dependence of the duplication and apoptosis rate on nutriments and also on density. And here is in that case it's just one nutriment and dependence on density. Or you can recognize that what people know very well is that basically you have nutriments on one side and you have oxygen on the other side. And oxygen penetrates much further down than nutrients. But the lack of nutrients doesn't kill the cells. They just are basically dormant. And the lack of oxygen kills the cell. So that gives you very easily the structure. But that's not original. I mean, other people have understood that before us, I would say. Something that we are working on is that, you know, starting from an epithelium now, and so the epithelium is the healthy epithelium is a dynamical structure where you have a little bit like in the dormant tumors, let's say, you have duplication at one surface, at this interface you have duplication. And you have apoptosis at the upper part, and you have a constant motion of cells. In fact, there is even morphology changes, but let's forget about that. So it's a moving steady state, and you can look at the stability of this guy compared in the presence of this guy. And indeed we find, so basically there are new kind of hydrodynamic instabilities, and you find that in these fingers the most pressure difference that you can develop is this homeostatic pressure difference between the two tissues. So you find back, even in that case where you would say it's not obvious that this homeostatic pressure concept would be useful, it turns out that still it is useful. Okay, I guess that's about all I want to say, and then we can come back on some discussions. But so I think there is very good chances for these microtumors, where so very early on when it's monoclonal, there's very likely that there is a nucleation process. And also, it would be consistent with a very early observation, which was that some metastasis originating from some tissue develop in well-defined tissues and not in others. So there are relations which equals seed and soil, which in that case would be controlled both by the steady state pressure and by interfacial tension. Our experiments show that some moderate stress can suppress, I should say, cancer aggregate rather than tumor, because it's not tumor, it's really cancer aggregate that we've been playing with. On a physics point of view, it's a very interesting state of matter, because around that critical pressure or that steady state pressure, it has no compressional modulus, so it's a fun state. We can show also that, I mean, you know, this the time which I've been introducing for the anisotropic part of the stress, I told you the sign is not guaranteed, and that shows that you can have an isotropic pneumatic transition driven by cell division. And this has been observed in a simulation by Frank on, he looked at that for different purposes, but he seen that, and of course that's something we are working on. And of course we know there are many other steps. And probably one message probably is that mutation which will escape in particular the tension terms that we've been discussing will be much more successful than those which don't escape. So anytime the system can evade from that, it will be more dangerous. So there was this virus question, so maybe we should come back to that. So what was? No, but I mean in the presence of the immune system.
Yes, you have some pressure, and then these small aggregates can eliminate the immune system. Because there is a signal from the immune system to the cell, and then and it's a very nice model, but maybe someone should try to figure out. This is why I was asking about the experiment on mice, because if it was ex vivo, in vivo, or in vitro, because then you should figure out what they were doing. But it's clear that in cancer, when you have this virus, you also have the immune system, and you have
Appearance
of these cells because of adhesion molecules and things like this.
Yeah, so somehow, I guess, but maybe it's a crude way of answering, but so the apoptosis rate that we are putting into the equation are some kind of renormalized rate. So it's a rate in the presence of the immune system. And so in some sense, it's included. Because it's except that you might say, I mean, we are assuming there is no explicit time dependence, for instance, in those rates, and you might argue that the fact that that the immune system might introduce explicit time dependence and so on, and then it would probably modify the description. But at least at that stage, it's included in the crude way.
What I was talking was about this critical radius.
Yeah.
You say that necessary to keep the aggregate. And sometimes you don't need to have this critical radius from a mechanical point of view, because you have the signaling of the immune system that can destroy this aggregate too.
No, but that's okay. If it's as you're just saying that the apoptosis rate is increased by the immune system. I mean, it's not apoptosis, of course, but this disappearance rate could be controlled, in some cases can be entirely controlled by the immune system. That's fine.
We should probably wrap up. A couple of other questions. Richard, you have a question?
I was just wondering when the T cell mediated killing would only be at the surface, or when the T cells would invade the tumor and kill, like, an autotroph. But I would
so if it goes only to the surface, it will change. It would change the analysis somehow, because this is assuming it goes also in the bulk. You're right. But I would say that there is a layer. I mean, and it's also a general comment. I mean, this very first layer has different properties, and so its apoptosis rate is different from the bulk, and so on. And duplication rate is different. But if you look at this, to say the millimeter steady state tells you that the apoptosis is larger at the periphery than in the bulk. Because it turns out that in most tumors, when at least from what I've read, the tumor take advantage from the neighboring tissue, and they grow faster at the interface. So it seems that, I mean, I would say those mutations, again, it has to do with evolution. Those mutations which you don't take advantage of the tissue, they disappear. I mean, it's not to say that they are not there. They are probably there, and there are probably plenty of them, but they disappear.